Okay, so so I just venture forth into a talk because I'm a little bit of the mind that maybe I shouldn't talk today and rather hear what's on your minds and just, you know, say something in response to what's important for you. Something important anyone wants to bring up for a topic today, or should I just venture forth? Venture forth. Well, keep it in mind that one of these Sunday mornings we'll devote more to kind of questions and answers, or you think of what's really important for you in your practice, and maybe ask a question or bring up a topic, and we'll just pick up from there rather than me showing up with some preconceived plan. One of the very important points of Buddhist practice, which I think many of you are familiar with, is that the heart of the practice is, one of the hearts, one of the central aspects, is that we focus a lot on our relationship to our experience. That our experience, whatever our life experience might be, whether it's pleasant and comfortable or unpleasant, uncomfortable, whatever those particulars are in some ways less important from the point of view of Buddhist practice than how we choose, how we relate to that. Do we relate to that with clinging, desire, ambition? Do we relate to it with aversion, resistance, fear? How do we relate? What's our relationship to whatever has arisen, whatever has occurred to us? So in a sense, in Buddhist practice, there's a great kind of willingness to allow our experience to be what it is. Kind of an acceptance or equanimity about what life provides us, presents us with. But then how we choose to relate to that is really the key area of study and practice. And this perhaps needs to be repeated often because many people in our culture, maybe in all cultures, put a tremendous emphasis on their experience. And they try to negotiate and engineer their experience to make a better experience or worse experience. And they judge their experience. And we often relating to the experience. Our experience is the object of our concerns. And we're kind of, some people are kind of experience addicts. And what we need to do in Buddhist practice is try to turn away from the preoccupation with our experience towards what is our relationship to that experience. And the relationship to our experience is often a place where our suffering gets born. The suffering that Buddhism wants to address is suffering that arises out of the relationship we form with our experience. And it can be, all kinds of experiences. I know this might be a really, really silly example, but it just happened kind of in a sense. I mean, it's a non-example in a sense. I apologize for how silly it is, but I was driving down here from, I live up in the hills here, and as I was coming down the hill, the gas light showed that the tank was close to empty, and I had to actually do an errand before I can come here. And so I wondered, I said, well, surely there's plenty of gas to get at least to a gas station. And well, the first gas station I came to was closed. So I wondered, well, kind of idle wondering. Well, what happens if I run out of gas? I have to walk, I don't have my little cell phone with me, which is, that's one of the reasons to carry with you in cases like that. So I wonder, well, I'll be late from the Sunday morning sitting. Maybe I won't even get there in time at all. And I could see inside my mind, I had various, if that was the case, I had various options. Whether to get anxious, upset, worried about the fact that I might miss the group, or this beautiful day, what's wrong with just being walking along Woodside Road on a beautiful Sunday day and Labor Day, and it's unfortunate that would be late, but do I have to get contracted or anxious? I can certainly do my best to try to get here on time, do all the things I can responsibly do, But does that mean I should interrupt my enjoyment of this beautiful day? How I related to that running out, possibly running out of gas, was my choice. And I could see I had this fork, whether I can get anxious about it or upset and kind of darken, put a cloud, dark cloud over my mind, or I figure, well, the people I'm going to are, know all this, so they're not going to mind if I don't show up, and so they certainly don't want me to kind of suffer because I don't show up, you know. So it's a silly little example, but it's an example that, you know, gets repeated 10,000 times in the course of our lives, and sometimes it's much more consequential than potentially running out of gas, which I didn't do. I found a gas station. So how do we choose to relate to our experience is really a central theme in Buddhist practice. And one of the ways of understanding the teachings of the Buddha is that to the degree that we can, we want to meet our experience with a good heart. We want to arouse in us a good-hearted relationship with what's going on. And the idea of a good heart is really important. A heart that meets our experience with goodwill, that meets our experience with generosity, that meets it with virtuous qualities, with our virtue, our desire for honesty and non-harming, compassion. And I think it's very difficult to sustain Buddhist practice over a long time unless we have some sense that we're connecting it to our good heart. The good heart is something which kind of inspires us or kind of uplifts us. And that uplifting is what kind of fuels over a long term our Buddhist practice, or any practice, any spiritual practice. And our good heart is something all of us have. And it isn't so, many of you might have immediately checked, you know, now I mentioned the good heart, say, well, you know, do I have one? And concluded, you know, no way, you're not me, you know, or he's talking about someone else. But a good heart is something all of us have. But this is a very interesting thing. It's not so necessarily, it's, you know, certainly something we all have, and I would say it's kind of innate, but it's not necessarily separate from our choices, the way we choose to respond to the world. And this is a very important point, because some people want to have their innate goodness be innate, be something that they kind of just is who they are by their very nature, independent of how they respond and react to the world. There was a beautiful, funny article some years ago in maybe Shambhala Sun, some Buddhist periodical, about a... Then he was 13 years old. He was a 13-year-old Tibetan Lama teacher who was born into a family. His father, I think, was from Montana, you know, Caucasian from Montana. And his mother was Tibetan. They met in India. And he was born into this family and was recognized as a Tibetan reincarnate teacher. But here he was growing up. He had done some religious training in India, but they'd moved back to Montana, and I think that's where it was. Maybe some of you remember the article, Montana or Idaho or someplace like that. And here he was, you know, recognized as a Tibetan teacher, a 13-year-old growing up in Montana, and of mixed racial background, which was quite problematic because there was a lot of racism where he was being raised, and he tended to bond with the Chinese in that community because they were also, you know, the odd men out, the odd people out in that primarily Caucasian community. And he found it a little bit odd that his best friends were the Chinese. But, you know, they just, that's what happens. It's like when I was in Hawaii. You know, Caucasians are kind of like the minority there. So it was very interesting to be in a situation where I was in the minority. I hadn't had that experience too often in my life. And so there were the, you know, Japanese and Hawaiian Americans who were more or less the majority. And I was going to school there. And so it was very clear there was kind of a prejudice against the Caucasians among the majority in the class. And one of the ways it took was a small way was when we were going to break up into small subgroups and kind of discussion groups or whatever, it was very clear I was kind of left out, and I would go into those little subgroups then of the Chinese immigrants, the Chinese immigrants and the Caucasians, as against the Japanese and the Hawaiian. It's kind of this, you know, we're always dividing ourselves up this way. It's kind of very unfortunate. It's one of the ways we relate to the world. So this 13-year-old Tibetan was that way also, in his experience in Montana. But one of the things he said was, that he was tired of hearing. He was 13 years old. He was tired of hearing these teachings in American Buddhism that you're innately good, that who you are in and of yourself is innately perfect or good. Or that he was tired of hearing this because he wanted his sense of self-worth to come out of what he did. And it's kind of like the next generation, right? As you know, is reacting against our teachings. Kind of, you know, it's the way it works, right? Things kind of pendulum swings. And one of the, and maybe that's the way it should be. You know, we're all kind of been traumatized somehow, many of us. And so we kind of, by certain kind of religious teachings here in the West, those of us who've been through it. And so we've kind of such a relief to hear this teaching, you know, you're innately good or pure, just the way you are. And all you have to do is kind of relax and go back into your innate purity. And the Buddha nature in us or something. And here was this 13-year-old kind of reacting to that kind of teaching and wanting his sense of self-worth come from, you know, how he chose to live in the world, kind of his responses and actions. And it can be both, of course, but our innate goodness of heart comes in part from how we choose to respond to the world. And rather than take that to be oppressive, which many people do, we can take it, hopefully, as a source of inspiration, that we can actually now pay attention to how we respond and react to the world. Can we let our reactions come out of our goodness, a way of a goodness of how we see other people, a goodness of how we see ourselves? Now, one of the important areas of study to allow this to happen is to investigate our thinking, our thoughts, our ideas, and our beliefs. And one of the, and this is a very important part of mindfulness practice, is to use our concentration and mindfulness in practice, not just simply to get calm and centered, not just simply to quiet enough, calm enough, to be able to relate and respond in good ways and kind ways to the world, but to actually use the concentration and calm to investigate what is it we're actually thinking. Not just train ourselves in letting go of our thoughts, but actually to investigate what are the patterns of ways in which we think, the patterns of beliefs that we have. So there are many kind of, for many of us, there are common patterns and we respond. We come into situations that are challenging to us, and a common ideas will surface. And these can be very quiet, subtle ideas, but they can be very pervasive and very influential. Some people have the idea that whenever they're challenged, they come into so many situations in life, they carry with them the little notion, I'm going to mess it up. For sure, I'm going to mess it up. Or they carry with them the notion that, oh, I'm not good enough to respond to this situation. Or they carry with them the idea, the world's out to get me. Things are going to turn out bad. People are out there to get me. That the world is, you know, the world is about conflict, and everyone else is out there somehow against, you know, to undermine my own well-being. So there's a sense of kind of constantly being on the guard because the world is out there to get me. Or there's many little ideas that we carry with us, little voices that we often will meet our situations with. And one of the ways to use the calm and concentration that comes through meditation is to start paying attention to the subtlety of the ways in which we think, the subtle ideas that we carry with us as values, as kind of truths, unexamined truths, unexamined notions of what we think is true, and to examine those. And one of the things to do is to notice the regular patterns. Whenever you find yourself in a situation that's a little bit trying, or a little bit uncomfortable, or a little bit challenging, is there a common pattern of how you will respond? Little voices that come up. And some of these voices are the subtle voices. On the surface, you might have very loud kind of thought concerns that are going on, but it's kind of like the second or tertiary levels of ideas of who you think you are in situations, or what you think is going to happen, which are not necessarily true, but are the burdens we carry with us into our situations. Now, it helps if the mind gets calm and concentrated to do this kind of investigation. Many of us are living kind of in the rapids of our thinking all the time. An image I've had sometimes is kind of like our thinking is like a geyser. I suppose is that the right expression? Kind of like a geyser that's bubbling up from the ground. It's kind of, and maybe you've seen these cartoons where, you know, the geyser comes up and the cartoon figure is kind of like gets pushed up by the geyser, and it's kind of like on his or her back, kind of like flailing about, kind of caught up in the geyser. Well, that's how many of us are with our thinking. And we're just kind of caught in the middle of the geyser, kind of bubbling away, kind of like shh. And the function of meditation is for us to kind of step off the geyser. The geyser of thought is still happening, perhaps, but we're not kind of riding and bubbling and on top of it. But we step off. We kind of get to the side of the geyser. We look at it and we go, "Wow, it's a big improvement on our life to be able to step to see the great, powerful currents of energy, of emotions, of thought, and see it rather than be in the middle of it and go, "Wow, wow." It's a great mantra. A practice. You should use this mantra a lot. Wow. And to step, you know, step kind of a little broadly, step off the geyser to see it. And in a sense that you can get kind of a broader and broader view. And, you know, perhaps you can kind of, you know, if you stand on a local hilltop and look down at the geyser, it's like, wow, you know, that's interesting. It's a natural phenomena. If you're right next to the geyser, if you're in the geyser, you're kind of bubbling up and down. But if you're next to it, you can kind of be amazed at the power, and you might be a little bit afraid of it, you know, it's because you might kind of step too close to it. But you get further and further away. If you're on a hilltop looking at it, it's like, wow, it's just this wonderful function of nature. So part of the function of meditation practice is to get the wow perspective. Is to kind of learn to kind of step off the geyser of thoughts, not live in the middle of it, not think that it's the only reality going, and that this is, you know, where we have to kind of set up residence, but to see there's alternatives to living in our thoughts, and that is to begin watching it and seeing it. And as the mind gets quieter or more expansive, then we see our thoughts more clearly. And as we see them more clearly, we see, well, maybe I don't have to live in those thoughts. Maybe I don't have to live by those thoughts. Maybe those thoughts aren't necessarily even true. And many of the conclusions upon which I've lived my life, I think all of you have some kind of conclusions that you carry with you about life, some attitude or about life that's very, very, very pervasive. And maybe because it's so pervasive, is invisible. And it often has to do with attitudes about ourselves. Sometimes it has to do with attitudes about others. The kind of phenomena where this Tibetan boy had to... He was the recipient of other people's prejudice. So sometimes these subtle attitudes that are constant are about others, not just about ourselves, but we carry with us. If we want the goodness of our heart to arise, we have to begin seeing clearly the thoughts by which we live. And then perhaps, are there other thoughts which are more useful to live by? Are there other ways of living? And in Buddhist spirituality, there is a strong emphasis on starting to choose to live by values which express our goodness. Values of kindness, values of generosity, and values of virtue, honesty, and compassion. And to choose those things. People in the kind of simple instructions of mindfulness, there's often no instructions to do anything. Just you're supposed to be mindfully aware of what's going on. And that's true when you do mindfulness practice. But a spiritual life is much broader than just bringing mindfulness, just bringing a non-dualistic awareness to the present moment. It involves also kind of calling forth something inside of ourselves. So we can choose to respond to the world in ways that are beneficial for the world around us and also beneficial for us, for our heart and our mind. And the part of the beauty of virtue is that the two are the same. That what is helpful and beneficial for the world around us is the very thing which is also helpful and beneficial to us. That to live a life of virtue, to follow the precepts, for example, to live a life of non-harming, that the rationale for doing that is that it could be either that it's beneficial for the world around us or it's beneficial for us. And the beauty about virtue is that both are true. You don't have to choose one or the other. That living a life which is non-harming, that is generous, is kind, is beneficial from both directions. As we do this, as we start developing and giving and watering and cultivating and our the goodness of our heart, this makes it easier and easier to discover a true heart as opposed to just a good heart. And the ultimate point of Buddhism is not to have a good heart, but to have a true heart. And a true heart is a heart which is unswayed by the conditions of the world, which is unswayed by pleasant and unpleasant experience, which is unswayed by praise and blame, which is unswayed by the various reactive forces in the mind that might come up. Anger, desire, fear. Those things might come up, but a true heart is bigger and wider. A true heart is untouched by the different mental qualities that might arise and pass. A true heart is a heart which is not dependent on how we choose to relate to the world. So we focus on our relationship to the world around us as an important part of being a human being. And in spiritual life, we try to bring forth a good heart, understanding how difficult it is to do that, understanding the necessity to have a good, forgiving relationship to our difficulty in doing that. But that sets the foundation for us to start then discovering the true heart, the heart which can just be unswayed, untouched, the pristine heart, the clear heart, the translucent heart, the empty heart. The big mind, as it's sometimes called in Zen, that can hold everything within it and not have to react to anything. To have the freedom, to discover the freedom where the heart and mind doesn't automatically react to anything, then becomes, in return, becomes a foundation that helps us then choose to respond and relate to the world through our goodness. So it's a wonderful cycle. As we begin responding to the world through the goodness of our heart, it gives us greater opportunity to discover the true mind, the true heart, which doesn't have to react to anything. And as we discover that, that gives us greater strength, greater ability to choose to respond with greater goodness to the world around us. So that's enough. Any comments or questions? How do you choose to relate to that? Yes.
I'm aware that I often say to myself, I'm not concentrating or I'm not capable of being concentrated. So that's an underlying theme.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know how it's one aware of concentration. When you're aware that concentrating goes away, I guess.
Or I missed that.
Where is
Oh. Well, concentration is the ability for the mind to be focused and calm and stable, composed on what you choose to be composed on. Many people can get concentrated by accident, you know, or, you know, if a police car pulls up behind you when you're driving on the freeway at 70 miles or 80 miles an hour, most people get concentrated pretty quickly. But it's not choiceful, it's out of fear. So to be concentrated in practice is to be able to, based on, kind of a choice, kind of a dedication, kind of keep the mind composed on what we want to be composed on. But what interests me is not so much that you identify what concentration is, but you said, because I talked about, you know, the common patterns, and you responded, one of my patterns is I have this idea that I can't get concentrated, I'm not concentrated. And so, for me, I would investigate that a little bit further, because it might be true that you don't get concentrated. What interests me is less your ability to get concentrated, but what's the underlying judgment that goes with that statement? Because it can just be a neutral statement. It happens to me sometimes. There are times I don't get concentrated, and I just notice, oh, I'm not concentrated. So what? I'm concentrated mind right now. But there might be some underlying value. Oh, that it's important to get concentrated, or I'm inadequate because I'm not getting concentrated, or there might be some other kind of that's kind of giving it a little twist. Is it that what gives that statement that statement for some people might come with some feeling of suffering. The statement itself, the recognition itself, I'm not concentrated, doesn't cause suffering. So what's the other value? What's the other ideas that are twisting it so that our mind gets twisted, our heart gets twisted into suffering? That gets really interesting. So that's the interest for me. I took your question as an opportunity to kind of exemplify what I was talking about in the talk. Is how do we turn back and what is it? What are the common ideas that keep popping up, and how is it? What's the twist in that idea that's causing us suffering? Hi. It's a good question. It varies a lot from person to person because different people have different minds and how they function. Some people are investigating all the time. They're kind of like, you know, that's what they do. Their minds think a lot. And so it'll happen just naturally. And sometimes for those people, you just want to encourage them not to do it because they're already doing so well that they should learn how to be more quiet when they're sitting. And some people have a mind which is uninvestigatory. It never investigates, and you need to kind of encourage them to kind of, you know, do a little bit more of it. There are various ways. One way is not to investigate at all, not to contemplate or reflect at all for a good period of time in one's meditation practice. And then when the mind gets really quiet and calm, when you recognize a really calm state, in that state, kind of bring up a theme to reflect on or focus on something. and use that calm and concentration for reflection. In mindfulness practice, we actually don't do reflection practice. But rather what we do is we investigate very carefully what is actually happening in the moment. And our thinking is one of the things that are happening in the moment. And so when our thinking is pronounced, we want to bring our careful mindfulness to recognize the thinking. But not to think about it anymore, but just to see it clearly as an event of thinking. And if you do that regularly, you might start noticing the patterns. If you start noticing patterns, then you might want to, outside of meditation, spend some time reflecting on it. Journal about it, or reflect on it, or talk to friends about it, or therapist about it, if you notice the patterns. But the ability to bring mindfulness to, that's why in Vipassana, we open to our full experience, our feelings, our thoughts, our body sensations, our reactions, all of it included. And so the idea being, with time, you will notice some patterns in your thinking, because you keep noticing, I'm always feeling guilty, you know, I'm always planning, I'm always doing something. One of the interesting ways of investigating the patterns of our thoughts is as we come out of meditation. So it isn't something you necessarily do during meditation, but to the degree to meditation is a little bit calming for people, or quieting, is as we come out of meditation, some people come out of meditation in the morning after the morning sitting and just kind of jump into their normal life again. But if you don't kind of rush into your normal life, but rather come out of meditation kind of quietly and start noticing, how do we tend to react and respond as we come out of our meditation? And this is an area of tremendous understanding, potential understanding. Maybe give yourself the 15, 20 minutes after your meditation to kind of get back into your normal life kind of quietly and calmly. Don't rush onto the phone or into your car and the radio and newspaper or whatever. But use that time to stay attentive to how the mind is reacting, how the mind is thinking. And this is one area where you can start seeing some of these patterns.
I just got back from a couple weeks of family, visiting my father and relatives and friends. And also in this summer, I've dealt with a couple of people that are fairly contrary. And a pattern that I've noticed for myself is that I tend to assume that it's personal.
Oh, yeah.
And so I've been kind of watching that, and certainly it came to a height being home, being back with my family. But I'm reluctant to kind of let go of it because I feel like that's what I use to investigate and to see if my actions are skillful. Is that if that feeling comes up for me, then it makes me step back and consider, how have I contributed to this? Is this something that,
great,
my action? And yet I keep having these situations all summer where all of a sudden I have this flash of like, this doesn't have anything to do with me.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this is like her medication is off, or this person is just generally contrary, and it's like something will happen and I'll watch it from a side, like with somebody else or something, and I'll go, oh, this is their personality, this isn't me.
Great. This.
And so how do you discern? I mean, how do you choose that point where you go, really, I mean, I could just let go of it and kind of merrily go through my life assuming that nothing has anything to do with me, which
that's a great,
that would be healthy for me for a while, but I don't know.
That's a great example, great situation. One of the qualities of people who do, I've noticed people do a lot of Buddhist practice, is they tend to the default is to always check into themselves. What's my contribution to this? And that's a real strength. It's a beautiful thing. I mean, if everyone did that, that'd be pretty good. But it also sometimes is a hindrance, because sometimes we're not responsible. Sometimes we need to look and address what's happening in the world around us and what other people are doing. And some people, in a different angle, some of the common kind of subtle values or thoughts that people kind of will use to carry with them in all kinds of situations, common themes, unexamined themes. One of them is whenever there's someone else is suffering or there's some challenging situation, they always assume they're responsible. Someone else is suffering, and oh, I'm, you know, I'm the cause of it. I have to kind of make things better for that person because if that person's suffering, I must be the person who's causing it. Another is if someone else is suffering or whatever, or you're suffering, the common reaction is, I'm not responsible for anything, right? That's patently absurd that I should ever be responsible for anything. It's always the other people who are responsible. That's another common kind of pattern. Some people react. And one of the interesting phenomena, of course, is when these two kinds of people get together. You know, the person who thinks that I'm always to blame marries the person who thinks that the other people are always to blame. It's a recipe for disaster. So the question is, you know, you find it's useful to have that approach, to always look at yourself and your contribution. And I think it is useful to kind of maybe take that as kind of a default. But one of the things you need to look at is, are you suffering because of it? Are you in some ways getting anxious? Or always being self-critical? Or always kind of being... Are you suffering in some way because you're constantly taking the stance, you know, what's my contribution? If you're not suffering, then I think it might be really healthy, a starting point. But if you are suffering, then you need to look at that pattern, see, you know, is this really worth it? Is this really an appropriate way of always living? So that's one of the guideposts. Are you suffering because of this attitude? The other is to notice: is it wise to always carry this? You know how, you know, maybe you notice that it actually keeps you blind a little bit to really understanding the wider situation as it really is. So maybe you need to train yourself to sometimes step out of that attitude and look at the situation fresh. And part of the function of meditation or mindfulness is to either in meditation itself or in daily life, is to have access to a point of view which is no point of view. To have access to a point of non-reactivity where you're not seeing the situation through any filters at all. And this is very powerful. Sometimes it's called the zero point. To have the ability to come to zero where you're not reacting or responding through any way at all. Just, oh, the situation is uncomfortable. Oh. Rather than rushing into habitual ways of responding. And most people don't have access to that zero point of non-reactivity. And part of the... But as people learn to kind of get meditation under their belt, they have a little closer access to kind of the zero point. And from that, that's a very, very powerful vantage point from which then to begin doing the investigation of what's really going on here in this situation. But if you can't find that zero point, then we're always going to be seeing the situation through our bias. So is that all helpful?
Oh, yeah.
So I would like to stop. It's time to stop. So thank you all very much. Oh, next week, I won't be here. And Joseph Bobrow is going to come. He is a Zen teacher in the lineage of Robert Aitken Roshi. And we've had a number of Zen teachers come to our group from the San Francisco Zen Center. And he comes from a different flavor of Zen. They do a lot of koan practice. And he's a very wise man and a teacher in that tradition. And I think it'll be kind of special to have him and his flavor to come speak to our group. So that's next week, and then I'll be here in 2 weeks for the potluck. Thank you all.